It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Climate change. It's been a major issue with huge ramifications for us, for future generations. Yet, it's been nearly lost in the clamor of this unusual election campaign. For example, during all three presidential election debates, that was a total of some 4.5 hours of debating. Less than six minutes was spent discussing the candidates' policies related to climate change. This half hour, we want to do our part to examine how the candidates and their parties view climate change and what action, if any, they say they would take. We want to have you join our conversation as well. Are you concerned? How concerned are you about climate change? Did it shape who you decided or will decide to support as a candidate? 1-866-780-9100. What specific policies related to climate change do you back? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on our Facebook page. Joining us for this half hour, Scott Spack is with us, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning, also a researcher at the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. And in this context, important to mention, he has a doctorate in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Scott Spack, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Also with us in our Des Moines studio, David Kurard Howry is director of the Environmental Science and Policy Program at Drake University, an economist. David, welcome into our studio as well.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
So the presidential candidates, we're going to talk about the congressional positions, too, a little bit later. But the presidential candidates' differences on this subject are fundamental. Well, to put it simply, Donald Trump claims climate change is a hoax, and Hillary Clinton says it's real. Let's listen to some of their words on this. This is Trump talking with conservative radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt last year in 2015.
I'm not a believer in global warming. I'm not a believer in man-made global warming. It could be warming, and it's going to start to cool at some point. And, you know, in the 1920s, people talked about global cooling. I don't know if you know that or not. They thought the Earth was cooling. Now it's global warming. And actually, we've had times where the weather wasn't working out, so they change it to extreme weather, and they have all different names, you know, so that it fits the bill. But the problem we have, if you look at, you know, our energy costs and all of the things that we're doing to solve a problem that I don't think in any major fashion exists. I mean, Obama thinks it's the number one problem of the world today, and I think it's very low on the list. So I am not a believer, and I will, unless somebody can prove something to me, I believe there's weather, I believe there's change, and I believe it goes up and it goes down and it goes up again, and it changes depending on years and centuries.
Okay, and also in a 2012 tweet, just to back up Trump's position, quote, the concept of global warming, he tweeted, was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive. Let's juxtapose that position with that of Hillary Clinton. Here she is speaking in Tampa on September 6, 2016. This is just after that Hurricane Hermine.
The next president will have to work with communities like Tampa's to prepare for future storms. When I'm in the Oval Office, I'm going to work with local leaders to make smart investments in infrastructure to help protect regions from flooding and other effects of climate change. I'm going to continue to work on the international and national level to try to turn the clock back, to stabilize and reduce emissions even more, to try to gain more time, but we're going to have to begin working immediately on mitigation and resilience and prevention as well.
Okay, Scott Spack, as a scientist here with your background in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, you are acutely aware of what's happening on our planet. Who's right here? Among world scientists who know the climate science best, how much disagreement is there?
Approximately none. So 97% of atmospheric scientists and climate scientists agree on the same facts. The American Meteorological Society, the American Geophysical Union, the major professional associations in the sciences, as well as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the governments of the world, agree on the facts that the climate is changing. Mm-hmm. More specifically, it's warming. It's been warming more recently than before. It's us. It hasn't stopped. the heat is mainly in the ocean. The sea level is rising. Glaciers and sea ice sheets are shrinking. CO2 is mostly the reason for this. It's up 40%.
So when recently. Someone says, well, we don't really know based on the short span of time we're looking at, you know, the climate goes this way, it goes that way on the planet, it has existed for millions of years. We know for sure that it's human action causing this?
We know greater than 90% chance that the specific levels of climate change that we've seen over the past 50 to 150 years are predominantly because of us. Mm-hmm. And okay. We know greater than 99% chance that it's happening.
Okay. What about this idea Donald Trump put out there that it's a hoax created by the Chinese? David, let me have you tackle that one. To damage us economically, right?
Right. So the idea would be that we would cut down on our emissions and that would hurt us economically. And so then the Chinese somehow win. There's not much to say about that. It's been debunked. The idea that it might be a hoax is sort of difficult to get one's head around anymore. And certainly the Chinese have agreed to a fairly rigorous to cut their emissions in some ways more dramatically than the U.S. And obviously their emissions are still rising, but they also have an economy that's growing so rapidly that not too long ago they were building, you know, two coal plants a week, and they have replaced a lot of that growth with solar and wind to the point where they're now significant powers in both of those fields. So the Chinese are definitely doing a lot to address climate change, and I guess the real question is, how do we come together as a planet to address that? And the deal that we have before us right now, the Paris Agreement, is a voluntary agreement. So the different countries have agreed to emissions cuts. The U.S. has said we're going to try to get our emissions down to down by 26 to 28% by 2030. And the Chinese have said that they're going to be peaking their emissions around the same time. So I think the question where the presidents might have an important impact is on, you know, how do we or whether we implement those agreements.
Mm-hmm. Gail is with us on the line. She joins us from Des Moines, 1-866-780-9100. Gail, what do you want to chip in?
Well, I really like Dr. Jill Stein's platform.
Mm-hmm.
I think she has the most aggressive platform. I'd like to know what you guys think about that.
Okay, very good. What about you, Scott? Can you talk to the Green Party platform? I don't know what Gary Johnson is there, but we certainly do not want to exclude the third-party candidates.
So each of the candidates has a statement, official policy statement on climate change. Is it real? Is it happening? And what to do about it? And Stein uses climate as the vast majority of her entire platform, which is about coming up with 20 million green jobs, coming up with a just transition away from jobs in dirty industries, moving them with retraining and economic support toward clean energy, leading a new global climate agreement that's more aggressive and not voluntary, and adapting agriculture, transit systems, environmental protection, and infrastructure as key parts of her platform. Johnson looks at more coming up with innovative energy sources and selling them to the world as a means of handling this issue. Clinton has a very specific set of policies very similar to the University of Iowa and Iowa State. 1 billion climate, 1 billion solar panels, a third reduction in energy waste, a third reduction in fuel use, some taxes, and a climate energy challenge.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, David, going back to the obvious mismatch between the science and the politics, depending on which political party you represent here. How do you explain that when there's a consensus, as Scott mentioned there, 97% of people in the know here, the scientists around the world, are in agreement that humans are causing this climate change, the warming, the greenhouse gases being responsible, caused by us humans, and that we in the United States are not in agreement that in that in a big way politically.
Well, I think there are a number of ways to look at that, and one is that, you know, we're as a country existing more and more in our own bubbles, where we talk to people who think like us and so on, and so don't challenge our ideas. Certainly, that seems to be the direction that conservatives have gone, in the sense that they're clearly concerned about the costs of implementing climate mitigation strategies, and so it's certainly easier to argue that it's not happening than to argue what Johnson is arguing, which is it's probably happening, it's probably caused by people, but regulatory responses might not be the right response. We often forget that as recently as 2008, you know, the Republican candidate John McCain had a cap and trade plank in his platform. So the level of the rejection of the climate of the scientific consensus in the Republican Party is fairly new, and certainly Trump represents an extreme in the party to some extent along those lines. It's I think the kind of thing you get when we just talk to ourselves.
Let's also talk about the congressional races. Of course, Congress has a say, certainly a big say, in what happens in terms of climate change policy, and we are a few days from an election. Here's Rod Blum. He is the GOP incumbent, defending his seat in Iowa's 1st District. Let's listen to him back in 2014, before the midterm elections, talking on this point, when asked if he is a believer in climate change.
I'm not a scientist. I know most scientists' paychecks come from the federal government, so I guess right away that makes me a bit skeptical. 30 years ago we were going into a global cooling period, that makes me skeptical. The planet's 4.5 billion years old, 4.5 billion. And I guess I'd say, how long of a time frame does a trend make? Does 20 years, you know, that make a trend? Because I don't believe the planet's warmed in the last 17 years. So, I mean, is that a trend now? Or I even look at 20, 30, 40 years out of 4.5 billion years and say, is that a trend? I'm not sure. Like I said, I'm skeptical. And then we have to be very, very careful, when we start talking about regulations.
Okay, so what do you make of that, Scott? If you were speaking to Rod Blum and he had just said that to you, well, how would you address his skepticism? Not only a skepticism, but his view of scientists, they're being paid for by the government, so we should we should be suspicious about what they say.
I and all the climate scientists I know have many other interests, and most of them would prefer to be doing something else that would be more valuable for the world and more important. And we choose this because it's the most important thing for us to know, for us to understand about how the world works. A big part of this platform from the Republicans is on this cognitive dissonance. If you agree that it's happening and you agree that it's us, then you would have to agree to do something about it. And about 63% of Americans believe it's happening. About half believe that it's us. About half believe that it's bad. But only about 6% believe that it's solvable. And so there's a political disconnection and a policy disconnection between what's happening and can we really do something about it without it damaging us.
Mm-hmm. Channing is with us in Des Moines. She dialed 1-866-780-9100. You're listening to The Conversation. Welcome, Channing. What do you want to throw in?
Well, this is really a great conversation, and I am one of the people I think you're talking about, a climate voter. it's become issue number one. And so what I'd like to know is, do the guests see a growing trend or a movement of climate voters who, you know, they might lean one way or another in the present election, but they're really looking for candidates or parties that will aggressively lead on the climate response?
Okay. Channing, David, can I throw that to you? What do you have to say to Channing?
Yeah, sure. And I think it depends a little bit on whether you're when Channing talks about the climate voters, whether he's talking about voters, you know, in the public or whether he's talking about candidates. So certainly in the public, it seems like there's a large number of people who care about the issue and who think something should be done about the issue. It's harder to demonstrate that they are voting on that issue, although certainly as we've polarized politically, the correlations have risen. Although there are definitely a number of people on the Republican side who, you know, claim in surveys to support climate action as well. So I think there are a good number of people who are voting on that issue, or at least care about it. It becomes complicated when we try to figure out, well, you know, what are legislative options, because we're living in this sort of post-legislative world where major changes don't seem possible. And so I think when we're thinking about this particular election, a lot of the question that voters should be asking is, how do the presidential candidates differ in areas that they have an impact on? So things like, you know, Supreme Court justices, the Paris Climate Agreement, so international conversations and regulatory issues.
And when we look at what American voters are concerned about 70% are very concerned about Islamic terrorism. About 50% are very concerned with the global financial system, and about 40% are very concerned with climate. So while millennials care a lot about climate, there are very few single-issue voters like Channing for whom climate is the biggest deal.
Mm-hmm. And also it has to do with, it's a longer-term trend here. It's not like an attack by terrorists at a certain point in time. It's not like your measurement of GDP or how much joblessness there is in the country. So will it ever be something that becomes so acute that it will snap to the front of the line when we prioritize our election ideas? David, do you think?
I think that depends a lot on the solutions that are available. You know, the cost of solar has fallen by about half what it was just in 2010. And I think that as solutions become more obvious, it becomes much easier to, you know, vote on climate. I think people used to fear that, you know, if we do something about climate, it would lead to dramatic economic costs, right? Now that solar is so inexpensive and wind obviously has been moving in that direction for a very long time now, now that we have other options, I think it becomes much easier to come up with solutions. And as that happens, I think voters, well, it's easier for candidates and for voters to sort of accept that maybe we can and should do something about it. It also makes it much easier for other countries, for example, China, to make progress without necessarily, you know, having the binding agreements that were the plan back when we were negotiating Kyoto.
Mm-hmm. What is the economic argument, purely in that terms, for getting a better footing in a green economy, David?
Well, I mean, certainly we're moving in that direction, like I said. You know, with the cost of solar dropping so fast and also the cost of electricity storage dropping so quickly, it seems obvious that sometime in the next couple of decades, we're going to have to make the shift, just because it's going to be cheaper, right? And so the governments can accelerate or hold that shift back, and which one happens matters a lot, whether we move forward or hold back. But the other side of the coin is that it certainly seems as if that's the direction the economy's going, the countries that lead the way in creating those new technologies and in working with those new technologies are going to have an advantage in the future economy. You just look at Germany, which has much worse solar potential than the United States because it's just darker in Germany. They can install solar much more cheaply than we do because they've been at it for a long time and they've gotten economies of scale and competition and so on. So that gives them an advantage in the marketplace of the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this email from Zach I want to read briefly and then ask you for your closing thoughts. We've got just a minute or two left from Zach, one of our listeners. Politicians shouldn't be debating whether or not it's real, but rather what each of their respective plans are to react to it. Renewable energy and technology plans, reducing fossil fuel dependence, and ideas for sustainable agriculture. That's part of Zach's email there. Well, it would be, I guess, it would be, we've talked about the mismatch. The debate is where it is, and there are a number of politicians that are in the category of not being convinced of the science behind this. With that in mind, in this context, Scott, tell us, what do we need to know before we go into this election if we're very concerned about climate change?
If you're looking for elected officials on a four-year election cycle to be leaders in what happens with climate, it's a short-term level of thinking. And climate is a long-term problem. And learning to, as a society, that the sooner that we deal with this, the cheaper it will be, the better our options will be in the future. And the longer that we delay, the fewer options we have and the more expensive it will be for us to adapt and to fight is the main thing for us to know.
Okay, David, about 30 seconds I can give you.
Yeah, no, I agree with Scott. We need to be looking long term, but we are at a point where certainly some of the decisions that will be important for whether the United States can meet their long-term commitments under the Paris Agreement are going to be happening before the next or during the next president's term.
Okay. David Howry, Director of the Environmental Science and Policy Program at Drake University. Thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks, Ben. It was great to be here.
And Scott Smack, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of the Urban and Regional Planning, also a researcher at the Public Policy Center at the UI. Thank you, Scott. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with a convicted felon and former gang leader, Jason Soule, about criminal justice. He'll be speaking in Iowa City on the weekend. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.